You're tuned into the Velo News Podcast. I'm Spencer Pollison, talking to Andrew Hood today from far away in Spain on Skype. Hoodie, how's it going over there?
Pretty good, Spencer. It's good to be back on the podcast. It's been a few weeks for me. I was in Australia for the Tour Down Under, and then I went skiing in Canada for a week. Talk about extremes, man. Went from 45 degrees Celsius, which is about 120 in the Outback, to minus 20 in the Canadian Rockies, which is about, I don't know, minus 10 Fahrenheit. weather shift there. So it's good to be back in cycling country.
Yeah, you might need to implement the extreme weather protocol there to keep you from freezing your tapas.
That's right. Ready for, really, it's almost been like spring training, hasn't it, these last couple of weeks? You know, you got these early season races. Everyone's getting a kind of a flavor for us. The road scene's kicking back into gear. And now, you know, we're getting into kind of some of the meatier races, and it really feels like the cycling season has begun.
I agree, Hoodie, and that is a great segue. Thank you for that. We are going to talk today about 3 one-week-long races that just wrapped up. We're going to talk about Volta ao Algarve in Portugal, as I butcher my Portuguese pronunciation, Ruta del Sol in Spain, and then, of course, we've got the Tour of Oman, which finished a little while back on the last Thursday, last week, and those three races providing some very interesting storylines, some insight into our riders and what they're doing right now, how fit they are, who's winning, who is not winning, and then, of course, Hoodie, we are excited because this weekend is the official start of Cobbled Classic season in Belgium. We've got Omloop Het Nieuwsblad on Saturday. Again, excuse my pronunciation. And then Kern-Brussels-Kern on Sunday. So lots going on, lots to look ahead to. Let's lead off with Volta ao Algarve, Hoodie. Again, my apologies for the pronunciation. Have you ever tried to speak Portuguese? I've never tried it. It seems like a really difficult language.
It's an interesting language. I remember one year when I was flying back over to Europe years ago, I was on a flight that went through Portugal. And I kept wondering, like, who are all these Russians on my flight going to Europe, going to Portugal, Spain? And it turned out that, you know, Portuguese is really quite rough, and it's kind of almost, the most Brazilian is the typical kind of Portuguese I think most Americans are used to hearing, and which is much softer and smoother on the ear. And when you hear real Portuguese from Portugal, man, it almost sounds like they're speaking Russian, which is kind of a bad comparison. But it's almost like Spanish when you're in Spain and you hear them speaking Spanish compared to, you know, the telenovelas, you know, with
you watch a lot of those?
Watch a lot of those back in the day.
Well, it's, yeah,
it's a beautiful country. It's a beautiful country, and the Algarve is one of the greatest early season races on the calendar.
Yeah, very apropos that you say it's a rough language when spoken in its home country there, because I would say this is a pretty rough race. It's a very challenging, a lot of narrow roads, some steep climbs, really a memorable summit finish on the final day up Alto del Malhao, I think is what you say. That was, it was quite a nasty sting in the tail there on the last day of racing on Sunday. And for me, Hoodie, one of my big storylines coming out of this is the young star, Tadej Pogačar. I think you have the inside line on the correct pronunciation of this young Slovenian's name, don't you?
Oh, I've been told it's pronounced Tadej Pogačar.
Okay, I was close.
You're very close. I'm sure we'll get corrected by some of our Slovenian listeners.
Thank you. Yes, we need that. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I had a chance to speak to him actually at the Tour Down Under last month, and you know, he quickly came out of the gates and delivered that. I mean, winning the Algarve as a neo pro, man, that actually says a lot, because that race has some pretty impressive winners on its Parmada, as you see some big GC guys kind of hitting their stride early in the season at that race, because it kind of features a time trial, has that mountaintop finish you spoke about, and you see a lot of guys kind of bounce out of the Algarve to have pretty good seasons later in the calendar. And to see the young Tour of Avenir winner to kind of manhandle that World Tour kind of caliber field, what a, you know, impressive first win, and come on.
Yeah, Pogačar just 20 years old. And what I really picked up on when I was watching that final stage of the race, Hoodie, was just the level of confidence and patience this kid had. He, you know, yes, he's got Fabio Aru at his side during this race, which is a great mentor to have for Grand Tours. Well, maybe not a maybe not the perfect mentor. He's pretty good. Fabio Aru has his ups and downs, but he had his team there. He had the UAE team pulling on the front, keeping things in check. But face it, when it comes down to it, this kid he's cold blooded. He saw the attack from Soren Krogh Andersen go up the road on the penultimate climb. This guy was just, I think, about 29 seconds behind in the overall. So it was a really dangerous move. Not only that, but he was joined by Zdenek Stibar. More on that in a second. And Pogačar just was fine with it. He said, okay, we'll let him go on this climb. We've got enough kilometers before the finish climb. I've got a few teammates to pull on the front, and I should be able to nail back that gap on the Alto de Mahao. And sure enough, he did exactly that. It wasn't like he was showing off and winning the day and totally blowing everyone out of the water, but he rode a calculated race and he knew how much time he needed to make up on the leaders, and he did exactly that to take the overall win. And like you said, this is a big deal to win Algarve. It's not a World Tour race, but certainly looking back at the winners of this race, you got plenty of stars who have come home with the yellow jersey in Algarve, including Geraint Thomas.
Yeah, that's right. It's a race with some growing prestige just for that reason. And when I was speaking to some of the UAE people at the Down Under, and they said that they'd already had Pogačar on their radar almost going back 2 years ago. You know, the pro teams out there these days, they're always on the hunt for young talent. They want to get riders into their programs in their early 20s and develop them into caliber riders that can win big tours already in their early to mid 20s. Which kind of is, you know, it's been a growing trend that's been changing in cycling. You know, you're still seeing riders win Grand Tours well into their 30s. But you're also seeing riders, I think, these days really getting chances to win and perform at a much younger age. And a guy like Pogačar, I mean, last year he basically won the Vuelta al Avenir, Tour de l'Avenir, almost single-handedly. Didn't really have much of a team. And the expectations for him at UAE are sky high. They just think he can develop really into a Grand Tour rider. The word is this year he won't race a Grand Tour in his kind of first Neo Pro season. That could change. I mean, last year, you know, Bernal got the Egan Bernal got the tip, you know, to go to the Tour de France. That was beyond expectations. So teams can change their minds about these things. Like Sepp Kuss last year wasn't supposed to race a Grand Tour. He was going so well, they took him to the Vuelta. So we'll keep an eye on Pogačar, but man, what a way to start, second stage race out, and you're a winner.
Yeah, very exciting. And I'm looking forward to see what he'll be able to do in his debut World Tour season. Like I alluded to earlier, Hoodie, another notable storyline out of Algarve before we move on is Zdeněk Stibar, the Czech rider on Jesunik Quickstep, winning that final stage. And to me, Hoodie, that's a great indication of what Stibar has got potential to do in the classic season this year.
Yeah, the sharp eye there, Spencer. I mean, Stibar, he's been like that guy that everyone wants to see win, right? I mean, everyone loves Stibar. Everyone loves cyclocross. He's been on that Quickstep team, which sometimes you see, I mean, the riders, you know, so many big riders on that team. It's hard to even just make the selection for some of those spring classic races. And then B, just have the dynamics stack up to allow you to be in position to win. A lot of times it doesn't work out for it. You've seen riders in the past, like Gilbert last year, I think had a great spring classics, but he never was really in position to win just because they were racing as a team. So the fact that Terpstra's gone, you know, they could open up some more possibilities for Mr. Stibar to get chances to win.
Yeah, that's exactly something I was thinking, given that generally it seems like Quickstep has had to scale it back a little for 2019. Yes, they're still a great team, and they're still going to win a lot of races, but I think that they're not quite as able to field a full team of superstars, and I think it might be opening the door for Stibar, although my question for you is does he have what it takes to win a race like Paris-Roubaix or win a race like Tour of Flanders, because he's come close many times, but he just never seems to quite have the edge, especially when he's up against a guy like Peter Sagan, for instance, who is, of course, you know, the guy to watch at the classics right now.
Yeah, I think especially at a race like Roubaix could fit Stibar perhaps better than any of the other classics, because I think he's been twice there second over the last couple of years. And Robais is the kind of race you just keep throwing the darts. You'll eventually hit the bullseye. And I think that this year there'll be a little bit more space for him to move in that race, because you do have some younger riders coming up in that franchise who will be getting chances at other races. But I think at Flanders and Robais, you'll see Stibar and Gilbert really trying to step up and take those big wins for the team. And I don't know, man. I think Quickstep, they'll still be a huge factor this year in the classics. They lost Terpstra. I think that was probably just a financial move. They probably couldn't match the offer he was getting from other teams. And, you know, they have such a deep bench there that they can still fill up their squad with, you know, eight or seven, you know, really capable caliber riders who can perform as a block and deliver results in almost every major one-day race in the Belgian calendar.
Well, there you have it. You gotta keep trying at Roubaix, and eventually you'll win it. I think that'll be my plan, Hoodie, for the next 5 or 10 years. I'll just keep heading over there, try to win it, and you know, who knows? Matthew Heyman did it, right? I mean, come on.
That's how he did it.
Let's move on to Ruta del Sol in Spain. It's really similar to Algarve, right? It's got a time trial halfway through. It's got a few uphill finishes. Personally, I get so annoyed that these races run concurrently, because I feel like they need more space to breathe and more potential to attract the stars to one, you know, so that it's not as much of a split calendar, right? I mean, why are they always on the same schedule like this, Hoodie?
Yeah, you know, I've often wondered that myself. I never could get a straight answer out of the organizations, because, you know, it'd be ideal to have them, you know, back to back over two weekends, right?
Yeah,
have them start, have the one race finish on the Tuesday, the next one start on the Thursday, and you can get them really caravanned, because they're obviously side by side geographically. It'd be quite easy to get, you know, really good full two weeks of racing in that same part of Spain. But I think the way the Ruta slots in with the rest of the Spanish calendar, I don't think they want to change their dates to accommodate the Algarve race. And the Algarve race evidently is happy with where they are. So I think there's like, each organizer has the reasons of why they want to kind of keep that same spot in the weekend, even though, you know, it just doesn't really make sense in the bigger picture. But the calendar is so full these days, it's really hard to, you know, because I think Algarve kind of fits in more with a French calendar. So if you move the Algarve, it's going to mess up some of the other races. So it's kind of a double track in these early spring races. So there's plenty of races for all the teams to go to. But I would love to actually, as you described, to see those two races back to back, because I think it would make for an interesting block of racing. But the Ruta, because they're both great races, great terrain, great fields, great weather usually.
Yeah, I agree. And I would imagine for the star riders, it's probably almost nice to have a built-in excuse not to face your top rivals in February, because it can be very misleading as far as what your form actually is and what your potential is to really build into a major event like the Tour de France. For instance, looking back to, I think it was Valenciana, seeing Geraint Thomas in that race, he did not look particularly fit or fast. He was looking a little soft, which is fine. I think February is not the right time to be in top form if you're going to try to win the Tour de France again.
Yeah, I mean, well, Geraint Thomas, I mean, hats off him to being honest about it, but he said that he admitted he was far off his top form, obviously.
Yeah,
he just wanted to get his racing legs and get a, you know, kind of old school ass whipping to get himself motivated for the rest of the season. He said, I had a chance to talk to him earlier this month at the Valenciana, and he admitted that he was he didn't quite do a Jan Ulrich, you know, back in the day.
Oh yeah,
Jan,
when right.
Puff up over the winning. He wasn't quite at that level, but he admitted that he was enjoying his status as a Tour de France winner. You know, he was going to spend a lot of time in the United States, actually.
Yeah.
Went to a lot of basketball games, and I think he went to a hockey game, and spent some time out in California. So he was enjoying life a little bit, something that, man, the pros these days, that if you take off that extra couple of weeks in the offseason, it's going to pinch you in these early season races. But he's confident that he can get back in top shape for the Tour de France.
Yeah, and I actually had a chance to interview him out in L.A. Back in January, and he's definitely having a good time. He went and saw an NFL playoff game. Yeah, he loves America, which is pretty cool. But not to get too far off track here, let's get back to the matter at hand. Ruta del Sol and Jakob Fuglsang, the Danish GC hopeful. He's sort of always been lurking in the top 10, top five of these Grand Tour GCs that he tries for. Hoodie, is this an indication that Fuglsang maybe is going to have a chance at actually winning a Grand Tour in 2019?
We'll see. I mean, he's always been hyped as a Grand Tour rider. Sometimes you wonder if maybe a guy like Fuglsang would be better off going off to try to win a race like the Giro or the Vuelta, rather than just going all in for the Tour every year when he's, you know, by his own admission, he's not going to be able to follow the guys like the Froomes when the accelerations come in the big, big mountains. But, you know, he's won big races like the Dauphiné and been competitive in those one-week races. So, you know, why not go to the Giro and try to win? That's what a lot of guys have done, guys like Simon Yates and Dumoulin. You know, that's kind of a road that I think really helps riders in their GC development, that for whatever reason, you know, Fuglsang has consistently gone to the Tour and consistently been in the top 10. He's had some bad luck going for the GC sometimes, but, you know, even this year he just said, you know, he thought he was going great, but he just could not follow those top accelerations. So we'll see. I mean, I know all the Danish fans love Fuglsang, and they hope that he can, you know, get close to that podium this year.
Yeah, ended up 12th in the 2018 Tour overall. So, yeah, it's just not really going to cut it if you want to truly stake your claim as a GC leader. Back in 2013, he was seventh in the Tour, which is, yeah, I mean, that's the type of result I would want to see out of him. But man, you know, now we're getting to a point where he is 33 years old. He's not going to get a whole lot better at these Grand Tour GCs. He's kind of reaching his peak. So you got to wonder. And I will say this, though, Hoodie, I think that based on what we've seen in the last few weeks, his Astana team is about as good as it's been in a long time in terms of maybe giving him that support he might need if he wants to make an impact on the Tour, which he is, by the way, slated to do in 2019. Astana team now with 6 GC wins so far in 2019, and we're only in the end of February.
Yeah, I mean, they've been the hottest team so far of 2019, without a doubt. You have to wonder if it was Lawrence DeVries and his Astana rap video that did. I mean, that has to be the difference, right, Spencer? I mean, come on.
You know? Yeah.
They're not from Uzbekistan. They're not from Kazakhstan. They're from Kazakhstan. Sorry, I messed up the guy's line.
Well, you know, let's just play a little of that rap right now so that we can remind our listeners of what kind of inspiration these riders have in the back of their minds as they go to these early season races.
Our leaders of the gang, this is Jakob Fuglsang and Lunchenko on the couple champagne bottle. It's Lopez Superman climbing fastest his plan. With support of the team, they are like a machine.
Ooh, that's good stuff, Hoodie. I bet you listen to that all the time back at your crib.
Oh, man, I got that right next to Snoop Dogg in the old school.
Oh, it's fantastic. But seriously, though, Astana, like I said, 6 GC wins. I don't want to talk too much about Tour of Oman since it's a little bit old news at this point, but Alexei Litsenko pretty much had his way with the field in Oman, won a couple stages, won the overall. It was really not even close, if you admit. It's just no one was really challenging him there, huh?
Yeah, I think the team, I think the team was coming in with a couple of key new riders coming, with the Itagire brothers coming on. They're going to bring some new kind of ambition and motivation to that team. Luis Leon Sanchez is healthy. I mean, he's kind of one of these timeless guys like El Valverde. He's been performing well and won already this season. It's one of those teams that, you know, they've had some good riders on there. Of course, they had Nibali and Aru have left, and now they're kind of stepping up their game. You got to wonder what happens behind the scenes there. Sometimes it's one of these teams that just seems opaque sometimes from the outside. It's kind of hard to get a good read on what's going on there. But I think that obviously, what they're going into this season is they're flying. They're the best performing team so far consistently in these early season races.
I imagine you saw them when you were down into Tour Down Under. Was there a certain kind of energy around the team there? Did you feel like, oh wow, Astana has something going on this year? It feels a little different.
Yeah, it was hard to read too much. I was talking to Sanchez a little bit every day. He was just talking about how he is real motivated for the season because he had that horrible crash last year, took him out of the Tour. And he still feels like he can be competitive. And he was just saying how the team was just really motivated to perform, you know, to be able to kind of prove that they're capable of winning big races without the likes of Nibali, who already left 2 years ago, and Aru, who left last year. I think there's a lot of ambition on that team just to kind of show who they are. We'll see if it carries on. I mean, sometimes with these early season races, it serves as a barometer for what comes later on in the season. But sometimes riders could hit, you know, kind of hit these early season wins, and then they kind of fade away when the meat of the season comes. So we'll have to keep an eye on Astana and see what they really do. And, you know, really follow up on this story and say, you know, what is Astana doing that's different than the last couple of years?
Yeah, definitely. Tour de France is a long way away, but we do have some classics coming up right this weekend, which is very exciting. Omloop's coming up. And the last point I wanted to make when it comes to Ruta del Sol is Matteo Trentin on the Mitchelton Scott team, the European champion. He won two stages there, and boy, I got to think he's going to be one of the top favorites for the Cobblestone season opener in Omloop.
Yeah, Trentin, you know, kind of a guy last year. I think he had had a crash. Kind of took him off the rails a little bit in some of his key races, but he still came back and got a couple of the big wins in his first season at Mitchelton Scott. You know, he's a rider who's capable of kind of, you know, finishing in a reduced bunch, who can get over the cobbles well, who's a rider who can kind of, one of these todo terrenos, who can kind of perform in different kinds of races in the spring classics. And he's like an old school Italian warrior. He loves the spring classics. I mean, the Italians really had a deep tradition of winning in the Northern Classics, kind of going back in the 90s and early 2000s. And I was speaking to him last year, and he's quite keen on trying to revive that Italian presence in the Northern Cobbles.
Yeah, like the old Mappe team. Let's talk a little more generally about Omloop to start off here, Hoodie. So this race comes on Saturday. It's considered the kickoff to the Cobblestone season. What are some of the key highlights of what makes this race special, why it's important to these riders, and what type of rider does well at this sort of race?
Yeah, I mean, it's the traditional kickoff to the Belgian calendar. So already right there, you've got just all the hype has been building over the winter. Everyone just in, you know, it's everyone in Belgium just loves the racing. So they've been waiting all season, you know, after the cyclocross is winding down. This is the first real big road race in Belgium. So everything just builds up to this. It's like opening day of the football season. The Belgians go crazy. All the top pros want to win. And, you know, you see some big winners, and it does feature cobbles, does get out and hit some of the bergs. It gives you a really good first kind of preview of what's really in store, you know, really still a month away when we get into the true Northern Classics. But it's the opening weekend up there in Ghent. It's always a big party. I mean, throwing back some Belgian beers and watching bike racing, smelling that the manure smell is in the air already in spring in Belgium.
You know, sometimes people like to talk about the curse of the Omloop, where the winner of Omloop maybe peaks a little too soon and doesn't quite have what it takes to be a real contender at Tour of Flanders. Would you say that still is the case, or is that type of thing that's maybe a little bit of an old-fashioned, old wives' tale? Because, you know, you look at Michael Valgren, who won last year in 2018. Sure, he's not exactly a Flanders guy, but he came correct in the later part of the spring season, and he won the Amstel Gold Race, which is, you know, that's a big one for sure, especially for a younger guy like him. And then, of course, we have Greg Van Avermaet, who went on to win the Paris-Roubaix in 2017 after he won the Omloop that year.
Yeah, I think, you know, winning a race like Omloop and having a risk of a curse, that's probably a bet that most of the top pros would take. it's a pretty prestigious race to have on your palmares. And like you said, you just rattled off some of the former winners. You know, Gilbert has won it twice. You know, it is a prestige win. You know, Fletcher won it back in the day, Husoft. And, you know, it ranks up there as, you know, one of the top one-day, you know, semi-classics that are on the calendar, you know, below the monuments. So I think the riders, they're all racing. You know, I think, you know, they're not going into the race 100%. So I think it's been part of that whole argument. If you're peaking now, late February, early March, you know, will you have enough gas in the legs to still be performing, you know, by the time you get into mid-April? So that's why, you know, you've seen winners coming out of Omloop, you know, really fly, perhaps hitting their peak a little bit earlier than they wanted to, and not having quite the gas to hold on the way through the full Classics calendar.
Yeah, and I guess perhaps maybe that's the reason why you don't see Peter Sagan on the start list for Omloop. And he hasn't really done Omloop for a couple years now, which I got to think is a little disappointing for the fans if they're really excited for Cobblestone season, they're ready to go, and kind of the biggest star of that part of the year is not present.
Yeah, last year his trainer and sports director Pachi Vila said that he didn't take the start last year and he's not racing again this year. It's just they were saying that for that exact reason they didn't want to put Sagan in the pressure to try to win because he tries to win every time he starts, because you know they really want him to be at his peak coming into the meat of the classic season. And already trying to be really strong from San Remo all the way through Liège, which is part of Sagan's calendar this year. He's doing Liège, I think, for maybe the first time of his career, but he's taken a pretty serious stab at it with that new course. So he wants to be strong for a pretty long window. So that's why they're kind of holding Sagan back, not holding him back from racing this next weekend, because he's had already a busy calendar. He raced in Australia and in South America. So he's training now in altitude, skipping this first Belgian weekend for the second year in a row. But that idea is they want him just flying unfettered come spring classic season.
Well, that's what we all want to see. We certainly love those big battles. Milan-San Remo, of course, being one of the first real major ones, but we'll get to that in a few weeks. The other thing to talk about for this weekend is Kern-Brussels-Kern on Sunday. Hoodie, I always feel like Kern kind of plays second fiddle to Omloop. It does not get quite the same attention or excitement as Omloop. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I think that it's because the courses are a little bit different. Kern-Brussels-Kern faces more of a sprinter. Usually it's kind of a you know, reduced bunch sprint, even though we've seen some great, you know, some kind of breakaways and
yeah.
people. Kind
Jasper of- Stuyven, yeah, that was a good one. Eh?
Yeah. Yeah, it was a good one. So you do see some of the exciting racing at both days, but you don't know. Omloop now is World Tour. Kern-Brussels-Kern still is kind of European Tour. So just I think by the nature of the course, the fact that it's the opening day, Omloop has always kind of had that prestige. It's an older race as well, and then Kern-Brussels-Kern's coming in just doesn't quite have the you know it's more like a Scheldeprijs, you know, kind of in the middle of the monuments. But I think both weekend races are big. I mean, you'll see riders skip one and focus on the day, you know, the next day, either one or the other, because it's pretty hard to actually race both back-to-back at 100% to try to go for the win. So you'll see guys who think they have a better chance of winning Kern will skip Omloop and vice versa.
Yeah, Omloop's a bit of a prelude to the types of terrain you see at Tour of Flanders, those cobbled bergs and that sort of thing. But we're looking forward to seeing both of them. And I'm excited for the cobbles to kick off. And certainly around here in Boulder, Colorado, very foggy and cold the last day or so. So it gets you in the mood for a little Belgian racing. While on the other hand, we do have some Middle Eastern racing that is continuing at the UAE Tour through the end of this week. And our fearless leader, Fred Dreyer, is out there right now, Hoodie. He is covering the race, and you can find all of his stories on velonews.com. And we're happy to have a little bit of audio from him coming straight from UAE, where he spoke with Brent Buchwalter, the American who made a switch to Mitchelton Scott this year, the same team as Matteo Trentin, who we were just talking about. So we're going to dive right into this interview with Buchwalter, and he talks about his transfer to Mitchelton Scott, his motivation he has to keep racing, the Australian culture of the Mitchelton team, which is very distinct, and it's the type of thing that makes it, I think they're fun, right, Hoodie? It's a fun team. You see they have a good time at the races, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, you hear that a lot of times within the Peloton, you know, there's certain teams you want to be on. There's certain teams that have a reputation of being pretty loose and fun. Other teams, I mean, a lot of times you can just see it in the team hotels. A lot of times you'll have two or three teams in the same, sharing the same restaurant every night. And you'll look over at some of these other teams and everyone's kind of dour and there's not a lot of conversation. You look over at the Mitchelton Scott table and those guys are always laughing and having a good time. And I think that shows esprit de corps kind of translate onto the racing as well.
Yeah, I agree. Well, let's hear from Brent Buchwalter.
All right. You're tuned into the VeloNews podcast. I'm Fred Dreyer. I am in a town somewhere in the United Arab Emirates and I have flown halfway across the world to have a conversation with Brent Buchwalter when we probably could have done this at some point in the States, but you know, we're international men. We like to travel around the world and go to bike races. So Brent Buchwalter, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Happy to be here.
So Brent, you are one of our esteemed rider diarists, and over the last few months, readers on the website have been reading about a few different parts of, you know, your experiences through pro cycling. And the biggest experience it sounds like you've had in the last few months is changing teams. You know, you started off with BMC. You were on that team for, what was it, 10 years?
11 years.
11 years. And you've now made the jump to Mitchelton Scott. I thought it was really interesting writing about the process of finding a new team. So, you know, take me through, you know, when you found out that, you know, BMC was going to be downsizing a bit, changing directions. What is your process at that point for finding, you know, a new spot to land?
That's a complicated process for sure. You know, so like you said, so much of my history is with BMC, my whole pro career really. So yeah, at first it was scary and sad and kind of frustrating and you know, disappointing. I think BMC contributed a ton to the pro peloton over the past decade, and I was really proud to be a part of that. But at the same time, recognized that the changing within that team was also a good time and good sort of spark for some change that I probably also needed and was ready for as well. So from then, it was just a matter of finding the right fit, finding the right opportunity, which was no easy task. Last year, as it seems like we say every year now, it just gets more competitive and more dog-eat-dog out there and a little more desperate as far as the job market's concerned. So there were definitely moments where I thought, like, you know, is this it? Like, am I gonna race again next year?
Were you at all thinking of domestic U.S. teams or Pro Conti teams, or was your heart really set on staying at the World Tour level?
No, I think that was definitely something that entered my mind. I think I'm at the age, you know, of the experience where I would be excited and inspired to, you know, be an older guy, more experienced guy, and a younger, more inexperienced team. But at the same time, I do still have that spark and fire to like be competing at the top level and really pushing myself and making sure I'm squeezing everything out of myself, you know, before I go that direction. So I was really open to anything, and I explored that route a little bit. And honestly, like no doors really opened or nothing presented itself. So ironically, there was more opportunity in the World Tour for me than there was.
So now we've heard horror stories over the years of what the rider transfer market can be. And, you know, you're putting feelers out through your own personal relationships. You maybe have an agent who's negotiating or who's like trying to find these relationships. With when it came to Mitchelton Scott, like how did you find out that they were indeed looking for a new rider? How did those, what was the pathway like?
I'd say it was something that didn't just happen last year. It was something that had been kind of in the background happening for a couple years. You know, we're at the same races with these teams, you know, year after year. So I think just by virtue of proximity, you know, you do have the opportunity to interact and get to know some of these directors or some of these riders. And that's really the first step to sort of identifying a group that maybe I would find a good fit. So, you know, in the years preceding, I saw Mitchelton Scott as I looked at them and kind of thought, hey, they have a good vibe. It looks like culturally they're compatible with me. Looked like they had good leadership and good resources, good support. So sort of, you know, began talking to them a little bit in years past and just laying the groundwork. And, you know, things never lined up and the doors didn't open, and I was happy to stay at BMC in past years. But yeah, fortunately, it was a good fit with this year where they had some roster vacancies that were sort of my type of rider, my position. And then, yeah, like you said, then, you know, the agents come in, the agents get involved. But, you know, I'd say, you know, myself, I was still fairly involved. I was still talking to Matt White, their head sports director, and I was involved in the process. And I think the fact that it was a team where I could be involved in that process was a good sign also that it was a place for me. You know, I didn't want to go somewhere where I had no interaction with the team prior, was unable to talk to their director, I didn't want to just be a number or a body that was filled into some spot. I wanted it to be somewhat personal and part of the process.
So you were on this team that had its roots in, you know, American and Swiss management. You've come to this team that has its roots in Australian management. You know, from what we know about Australians, they like to joke around, like to drink beer. It's definitely sort of a cultural persuasion on that. How have you found it from a cultural standpoint? You know, you're 2 months into the season, fitting in with this team.
Yeah, it still feels very new, and I like it, but it is also very different. yeah, BMC definitely had that element of that Swiss precision exactness. And the Australians have a little more of the laid back. It's a little more fun, a little more easy. That's not to say they don't take it very seriously, but I think that Australian sort of DNA and culture and identity, and even some of the Australians that they've had for the past 8 years, they really impact the team's culture. And we see that, you know, from, you know, the race meetings to the training camps to being on the airplane with them, traveling to the airport. So yeah, it's fun. I'm really enjoying it. I'm loving the group, but it's challenging. I didn't realize until I was sort of within the new group how much I had sort of taken the old system for granted and just banked on that, and it was just sort of automatic in my subconscious of how I existed. So it's challenging.
So the second column you wrote for us was all about your interactions with the media. You know, you've been a pro cyclist for good chunk of your life. You've had to sit down with pesky reporters like me and field questions. And, you know, I'm curious, you know, in reading that blog, have you ever had an antagonistic experience with media? You ever had an experience with a reporter where it was like, man, it just wasn't really, it was like kind of testy?
Oh, yeah, I'm trying to think of one specific example. Yeah, I think the most emotionally charged and testy moments are always just those post-race, you know, high energy circumstances where that reporter is looking to capture that emotion and energy that, you know, we just experienced in the final, and we're just, you know, wanting to, you know, as the Australians say, bugger off and get lost. So yeah, that's challenging. But yeah, generally I think as pro cyclists, we are so accessible to the media, that I feel like in general, they don't have to push that hard, and you guys are usually a pretty good group to work with.
Yeah, I've, you know, seen this in my own experience where sometimes you know, you do want to get a soundbite out of a guy, but maybe it's after a crushing defeat or after like a near miss, and you can tell that the mood is really down, and it always takes a little bit of navigating the personal relationship or, you know, seeing where a guy is at before you come in guns blazing. You know, do you have any memories of, I don't know, having almost one, you know, agony of defeat moments where you kind of have to collect yourself before you talk to the press?
Yeah, I mean, that happens all the time. One of the most challenging aspects of that dynamic is that, you know, you guys watch the races on TV, or you're listening to the race radio, you're getting the updates, but you know, I'd really say you still only see about, at best, 50% of what's happening out there. So, you know, we come to the line and the media has sort of an impression of what happens or how we faltered or how the team allegedly fell apart or where we didn't have it. And, you know, really there's countless other things that unfolded. And it's hard not to get defensive and a little riled up about, you know, people not being able to see that.
Do there tend to be a specific national media that seem to know the sport better? I mean, I know a lot of American media, especially if you're like racing Tour of Utah and you have local reporters there, they're kind of trying to understand the sport or asking some more basic questions. Like, what national media tends to really, really know cycling?
I'd say, like, you know, the Belgians think they know it. Yeah. they seem to be the most confident and almost cocky and secure with what they think is happening, and they love to judge and critique. Yeah, I'd say the Americans...
Oh, Brent, why didn't you pull through?
Yeah.
You're not strong today?
For sure, it's easy. For me, you step on the pedals and you put it in the big plates.
I think it's normal to win.
But it's not. I think actually, you know, probably for me, the Americans, you guys have the best understanding because, like you just said, you flew halfway across the world to be over here too. And that dynamic is deeply rooted in our experience in the races, being away from home and being in this foreign place and being on streets we didn't grow up on. So I relate well to the American journalists.
You know, your most recent column was about the Grand Fondo that you put on. The book Welter Binge goes on. It's in the early season, right? It's December or January?
October.
October.
I actually have to go sign in now.
All right. But Bookwalter Binge, check
Binge.
It out.
Yeah, it's October 25th this year in Nashville, North Carolina, where I always love going home and going back to. And it's a great way to celebrate the end of the race season and, you know, introduce some fellow riders to some of my pro colleagues and have a great time on the bike.
Do you see that as a business for you after you retire?
Oh, right now it's a bad, it's a net negative business. we're just trying to raise some money for some good regional causes. But yeah, as far as, you know, putting on an event and connecting with people and showing them, the love and joy of cycling in an amazing place, I'd like to think that I could translate that into some sort of post-career opportunity.
Brent, go get them. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Fred. Sorry to cut it short.
No worries. All right. Take care, man.
Thanks, man.
That was perfect.
All right.
Well, Hoodie Bookwalter, always one of our favorite guys to hear from, and he likes us American journalists too, which is nice to hear.
Yeah, Brent is he's one of the nicest guys in the Peloton. Smart guy, interesting character. You know, really part of a core part of that BMC team. For I think he and another one of his other guys, the Weiss, were the two guys from that team from when it started as a little Pro Conti team, all the way through winning the Tour with Cadel, through the last years with Richie Porte. So it was good to see Brett get that chance to switch to Mitchelton. He says he's pretty happy at that team. And you know, that team needs riders like Brett Bookwalter to kind of guide these guys like the Yates brothers around. And Swain Tuft is gone racing at Rally. So that's a perfect role for Brett to slot into. He has that experience of winning Grand Tours, of winning a Tour de France. And that's just what that team needs, to have kind of a core center of kind of a road captain.
Well, he'll have to still work on his barefoot meditation in the woods if he really wants to fill Swain Tuft's role at the Mitchelton team. But I'm sure there's time for that. So, Hoodie, let's wrap this up. Let's wrap it up with a few predictions for this weekend's Cobblestone Classics opener. You want to go first for Omloop?
Oh, I'll go with everyone's favorite coulda, shoulda, woulda been Tim Wellens. He's had a pretty good start to his season. Maybe it's not the it's not the ideal course for him, but I think he's obviously already firing on good form, and got a couple of wins at Ruta. So sometimes you got to think outside the box. If you're flying now, that's a race you could win.
I agree, and let's not forget that it was won from a small breakaway last year, so not out of the question. For me, Hoodie, I'm going to say Matteo Trentin. He's just on great form, and I think maybe this will stay together this time and be more of a select bunch sprint rather than the little breakaway that we saw last year. Now, let's move on to Kern-Brussels-Kern, Hoodie. This one, little different. Like we said, it's more of a sprinter's race. What are you thinking for this?
Oh, I'm guessing who you'll pick, so I'll go with somebody else. Maybe I'll go with DeMar. You know, he's the big Frenchman. He's always good for a couple of big wins during this season. He won San Remo a couple of years under controversial conditions.
Yeah, people forget.
And he's he's a rider who can step up and win these kinds of big races. I kind of like DeMar's profile, so we'll go with a French winner on the Belgian roads.
Yep, DeMar, a couple second places in the bag coming out of Algarve, so not a bad choice. For me, I'll just go with the obvious one, which is Dylan Groenewegen. And he is, of course, your defending champion from Kern last year, expert sprinter from the Netherlands, and also a winner at Stage 4 in Algarve, which was one place ahead of Mr. DeMar. So I think Groenewegen's got a great shot for Kern, but it should be an exciting weekend of racing and certainly not one that's easy to predict, which is why we love it, right, Hoodie?
That's right. And I will add a little caveat to my Kern-Brussels-Kern pick.
Oh, yeah, okay. All right.
I'll throw in Jasper Philipsen of UAE Team Emirates. He's being bandied about as the new Tom Bonin.
Mm.
Got that sprint win at the Tour Down Under when Caleb Ewan was disqualified for headbutting, and then came out of the Algarve, didn't get a win, but I think he finished third in one of the sprints, and he's slated to race both weekend races. And then Belgium, they're just so hyped up for this guy. This is the guy they think that can be the next big breakout star. You know, he kind of decided not to join Quickstep or one of the big Belgian teams and join UAE, because where he thought that he would get a chance to race all these big races, where, if you go to Quickstep, you're not going to make the selection for every race on that competitive team. So he'll be in these races both Saturday and Sunday. So watch for him to kind of maybe deliver the big ride and that Belgium for those Code Bombers.
All right, Hoodie. Well, I wouldn't usually allow a double pick, but you did a nice job of explaining it, so I'll let it pass this time. Thanks for listening, everyone. Stay tuned for the Velo News podcast next week as we break down all the action from Omloop and Kern. Enjoy the bike racing this weekend and stay tuned to velonews.com for stories on all of these races, as well as the UAE Tour, which is ongoing with our dear sweet leader, Fred Dreyer, at the helm covering that race. Thanks for listening.